Welcome to session 326. It's called Another Dawning of a Brighter Day, Mormon Literature in the 21st Century. And I'm Eric Samuelson. I'm here with Chris Bigelow and Tom Kimball. And we're hoping to have sort of a freewheeling, and in this case, hopefully at least somewhat democratic discussion of the various issues regarding publishing and literature and writing generally as we head into the 21st century. And there's several issues that I'd like to address. I'd kind of like to toss some of these issues out and then just let our other two panelists wrestle with them. The first is that the premise of this particular session asks us to look back 25 years to Gene England's article where he talked about the dawning of a new age of Mormon letters. And it says a little bit historically where we are, what has happened since 1982, what are the trends that are both encouraging and discouraging within the realm of LDS publishing. Surely at least one of those trends would be a kind of corporatization of publishing. My wife works for BYU Studies, and at BYU Studies they refer to Deseret Book as Gospel Source Rex, as they've now purchased Covenant, they've purchased Crawford, they've purchased...
Siegel. They purchased Infobases,
yeah.
And they bought LDS Living Magazine.
LDS Living Magazine.
XL.
They purchased XL, of course, Bookcraft, we know that.
I'm hoping that they'll purchase Signature Books and give me a big, fat severance package.
Or ways. Similarly, the emergence of smaller publishers, and I think that's one of the issues that Chris plans to address. A third thing that I think we'd have to note that has happened has been, surely since 1982, a far greater interest in national markets by national publishers in LDS authors, works with LDS subject matter and so on. And then finally, now the phenomenon of online publishing, on-demand publishing, and the challenges that, in terms of just the dissemination of information caused by that great democratizer of information, the Internet, and what that might be, what the implications, both positive and negative, might be of that development. So let me turn things over to Chris first and go ahead and talk, and then we'll go to Tom, and then we'll just open things up for a sort of broader discussion.
My name's Chris Bigelow, and I kind of got involved with this Mormon literary scene as a graduate student, and it was partly your fault, Eric.
Oh.
I went and saw a play at BYU Accommodations, probably back in about
93, 94.
Okay. When I saw that play, I realized you can do more with Mormon literature than you can get at Deseret Book. So that started me along the lines of thinking, what can we do to broaden the areas that we publish in the Mormon culture? And I was fortunate enough to get into Eugene England's Mormon literature class at BYU, which was wonderful. I mean, he has all that historical and critical background, and it was a wonderful introduction for me that got me thinking even more along the lines of what does Mormon literature mean and what are the prospects. And then I got involved with the Association for Mormon Letters, which I believe is sponsoring this little session of ours. I don't know if you're familiar. Are you familiar with the AML, Association for Mormon Letters? It's a small literary group. They run an online email discussion that's quite active and discusses all kinds of issues and things related to Mormon literature. So I got very involved with that and made a lot of friends and contacts. And then I was asked to help turn their little newsletter into a Mormon literary magazine. And so I was involved with that for 5 years and met a lot of different Mormon authors, and we did this magazine called Erie Anthem for about 5 years. It's still going on. I was involved for about 5 years. So after Irriantum, after I passed the torch on that, I still wanted to be involved with Mormon literature. Not a fan of what I could get at Deseret Book. About the only outlet for good Mormon literature were you folks at Signature, really. But you only publish a couple of fiction or so-called one or two a year, or just one. Okay, not a lot, but I'm grateful for that. But with all these associations I'd had, I was aware of some good manuscripts that were out there floating around, Mormon topic, novels, memoirs, and so I thought they needed to be published. And what made me decide to get involved recently as a small publisher, about a year ago I started a small outfit called Zarahemla Books, and what kind of made me decide to do that was the technology has just gotten incredible for how you can do publishing. And when I saw that it was possible to do without too much money, without having to spend a few thousand dollars to print a 1,000 or 2,000 books and keep them in your garage until you can figure out what to do with them, the technology now allows you to print digitally, basically on demand, as small as one copy of a book. That's what made me think, okay, it's going to be a small niche market. A lot of these types of books aren't going to sell thousands of copies because it's so hard to get them into the stores, the LDS stores, but there's still a market. And I'm really looking forward to hearing how Tom handles the market. I'm sure you have all the answers, right?
I've got them
there. But so I started doing this, and I'll go ahead and here's a new book that's just come out, and I'll pass it around a lot so you can just look at the quality of the digital publishing. There's a company called Lightning Source.
Laverne, Tennessee.
Yeah, and they're actually owned by the biggest book wholesale distributor, and they've set up a wonderful program that allows really small publishers to actually economically at least recoup costs with only selling a few dozen or a few hundred copies of a book. And so this is significant for Mormon literature because there really is a small niche market of people who are willing to read outside the lines of the usual Deseret Book Fair. And have you heard of the long tail economic model that's been discussed? There's a book called The Long Tail. Is this familiar to anybody? No? It's one of these big buzzword business books that came out in the last couple of years by the managing editor of Wired magazine. He has a really interesting model that there's a few, and it has to do with things like publishing and movies and music. Big corporations that put out this kind of material, they rely on big sellers to pay for all of these high overhead costs and things, and then they are able to pick up a few projects that might not sell as much and then let the best sellers kind of carry them on their tail, right in on their coattails as far as making ends meet economically. But with the long tail, what happens is because of the internet and digital publishing, you're able to, this tail of what is available stretches way out. So you've got your best sellers at the head of the snake, as it were, and then it kind of just, it tapers down as to how many copies are actually being sold of some of these works. But this tail now extends way out, because anybody can put a book on Amazon.com, and anybody in the world can order from Amazon.com, and that it can be done with just a few, it can be done with just a few dozen copies. So there you are, way down in this long tail, but you're still viable economically, at least recouping your costs because of the technology. So that's where I'm coming from. That's what made me think.
Chris, let's just make sure we're absolutely clear about what we're talking about. In other words, if I want to buy that book, you don't have 50 copies in your garage. I would send a credit card order to you via the internet.
Right.
They would print that book just for me, mail it to me, and I'd get it in 2 or 3 weeks.
That's how it works a lot of the time.
I actually visited the Lightning Source warehouse, or the production facility. It's in Laverne, Tennessee, and they have these giant circular rolls of paper. Excuse me. And they're running this piece of paper, or this strip of paper, through a press, and then there's a stainless steel bar that they wrap it around that allows them to turn the paper upside down. It goes to another press, prints the opposite side, goes to the end, and there's a barcode at the first at the front of the book, a barcode at the end of the book. It's chopped, and then put into book blocks with the barcode on it. Another machine with another sheet of paper, a thicker sheet of paper, is running through and printing the covers, and with the matching barcode on the back side, and it chops them chunk as it comes through the machine. And there's another machine that matches the two together, and the book is perfect bound, stuck together, and comes out the other end a book. And this machine is running at a high speed. They're printing 2,000 books at a time with an average print run of 1.8 copies
per title.
And they're across the street from Ingram. And so if you were to order the book, let's say, on Amazon on day one, it's printed on day two and delivered that evening to Ingram, who will ship it out the next day. So instead of sitting with, I was talking to Darren Smith, he has 5,000 copies of his book sitting in his garage. With this technology, you spend your $200-$300 on your book. With them getting it set up, you still have to have it designed and all that prior to and edited and all that prior to getting there and your ISBN set up. You pay them the $200 to $300 to get the book set up.
Not even that much.
And yeah, I'm overstating it, so that they'll be pleasantly surprised. and then what happens is as it's printed, the price of the book is around what $250 to create is what they charge us.
It's higher. It's about $4 to $5.
Oh, okay.
200 to 300 page. Book.
Maybe that's for you. No, I'm just kidding. I need to overstate it. So I thought I was overstating it, but yeah. Okay, so it's $4 to $5. It retails at $20 bucks, and so the difference between the wholesale price and the production price, they just put that money in an account, and once it hits $25 or once a month, then they send you a check. And so really, you have no accounting. All you're doing is you're creating the book, giving it to them. You
then
pay,
anything can be done.
And they list it on Amazon for you, and literally, you're done.
Yeah.
You're just collecting checks.
So the production of books has gotten much easier with the technology. The distribution, I mean, if you upload a book to a Lightning Source, it goes to Amazon, it goes to Barnes & Noble. Any bookstore in the country can order it. But that's the problem. Production's great, distribution's great, but there's no way to actually do sales work. You got to do your own. You got to still send out review copies, which I do. When I do a new title, I usually go ahead and print 100 to start with, and that's usually all just to send out to reviewers and bookstores as samples to try to... Because a bookstore can easily order it through Ingram. That's the largest wholesaler, and that's where they order other books too. I think even some of the LDS stores,
yeah,
have Ingram accounts.
Every decent bookstore, even the mom and pop shops in America, order through Ingram.
Yeah, so this is seamlessly fits into that. I'm going to try an experiment next week. I'm going to go to the annual LDS bookseller convention. Anyone ever been to that? It's really quite interesting. It's well, yeah, there's books. Books only represent about, what, 30% of the...
If that. 5-10%.
Do you get any orders ever? From LDS booksellers?
That's a very nice thing to say.
I think Morgan Kitchell needs to get on the recording. So.
I get orders.
Or do the sales and get them in the stores and stuff.
Okay, that's an interesting discussion, and it's a tragic one. Traditional bookselling is that the publisher produces the books, we wholesale it out to large wholesalers such as Ingram, Baker & Taylor, and the like. We give them around a 50 to 55% discount to the wholesaler. They sell it to the retailer at 40% off of the retail price, so they're making a 10 to 15% margin at the wholesale level. And then the retailer would make the 40%. And the publisher makes the difference between the cost of production and the wholesale price. In the past, when there was tons of mom-pa stores before the big box stores came in, if you were a good press, had good product, you would sell the book to the wholesaler, they would send it to the retailer, everyone was kind of being careful about the numbers of books that they were getting in, and yes, you would get returns, but they also the mom-pa stores also knew that if they returned a book damaged, that it wouldn't be accepted, and they needed to find a way to blow it out or somehow get their money back out of it, because the publisher was not going to take back shelf-worn books. But they could return the book if it was in good condition, still in the shrink wrap, so on and so forth. The problem that happened in the 90s is that the big box stores came in and started squeezing out the mom-and-pa stores. And there was a new strategy for them to make money. They would order, let's say they would order 1,000 books from us through Ingram or through the distributor, and they have 30 days to pay. The wholesaler has 90 days to pay. Well, at the end of the 30 days, whatever hadn't sold, they would return to the wholesaler and then immediately reorder them again so they didn't have to pay that bill. And in the process of moving the books back and forth from the wholesaler to the retailer, quite often they weren't even using any packing material. I can't tell you how many times today I get books back from giant wholesalers with zero packing material, and they came all the way from the East Coast. The books are shredded. And in this process of back and forth, all those damaged books come back to us, and we're talking, we print 100 books, we could get as many as half of them back, and all of them are wrecked. And the big box stores were saying, we're not taking back the damaged ones, you just need to eat them. And it's put thousands and thousands and thousands of publishers out of business, because you can't publish 1,000 books or 10,000 books, get half the print run back, and have to eat them. And so it ruins the relationship. And here's the wholesaler in the middle. You know, it's not them. It's the big box store, and it wrecks. But we're only dealing with the wholesaler. We're not dealing with the big box retailer, and so it wrecks the relationship between us and our wholesaler. And when that relationship gets ruined, and I mean really ruined, then how do you get your books out? So the mechanism over the past 10 years of getting your books from the press to the people has been damaged and broken, and you start worrying about the literate availability for America for good quality published, edited, well designed productions because of the breakdown. But one of the bright stars in this has been the print on demand, and also Amazon.com. Amazon.com isn't a walk-in bookstore, so they don't have to actually keep much inventory. You order the book from Amazon, they in turn immediately order the book from one of the wholesale distributors, and they order it from us. And yes, it takes a little bit of time, and if it's a good-selling book, Amazon will actually have inventory in stock, even if it's only a handful of books, so that the book turns around that day. But But Amazon is the one bright star out of all of this, where you can actually get books from the publisher to the consumer without the books being damaged and so on and so forth.
What about the
how does Barnes and Noble fit into that? I know you don't put them in the stores.
They're one of the big box stores.
But what about barnesandnoble.com? Can you specify that it only be sold over the internet?
You can't.
Well, actually,
not that I know.
Actually, with this Lightning Source company that does the digital printing, they get listed on barnesandnoble.com just like amazon.com, right, just automatically. So that's one way to do it. And they don't go into the Barnes & Noble stores unless a local store orders it. You know, the buyers in New York aren't going to order it for all of the Barnes & Noble physical locations. So I wanted to ask you, Tom, a little bit about the LDS market, the LDS Booksellers Association. How do you get books into those stores? Do you know?
They're suffering the same way in which the national market is suffering, in the sense that there's been unfair business practices by the bigger box LDS stores. And we've, you know, I started with Desert Book when I came into the business. I just come back from overseas. My father was dying. And, you know, I told my wife my fantasy was to work in a bookstore. I'm just going to go work Christmas help. In 2 months, I promise I'll go find a real job. And, you know, that was 13 years ago. And I had a delightful experience with Desert Book. I love those people over there. And when I worked there, they carried great books. They carried Sunstone Dialogue. They carried lots of signature book titles. They carried lots of national titles. That's no longer the case. I haven't had... I've only recently had a book ordered from Desert Book from our new list. I haven't had any others ordered in the past 5-6 years. It was the Thurston's book on genealogy. That was the first book since The Marketing of Sister B in 1991, I believe, is when that came out. That was the last book they ordered that was new. So it's difficult. We published several BYU professors over the past 5 years, their fiction, their studies, and they've carried none of it. So it's the same with in the LDS booksellers, the mom and pa shops, all the moderate to liberal bookstores have kind of been pushed out, and so you're really forced with this glut of very, very conservative bookstores across the spectrum, that they're really looking for very, very conservative, fluffy, lightweight LDS books. And it's unfortunate. You know, Chris and I, our great grandfathers were brothers, and their nephew from their big sister was Orson F. Whitney. And it's Orson F. Whitney that said, you know, one day Mormons would have their own Miltons and their own Shakespeares. And with this environment that exists at the moment, I believe that we have Miltons and Shakespeares, but there's no way that the average Latter-day Saint will have access to them in the way the environment is at the moment. Thurston, don't let me get away without talking about Amazon and your book by the end of this, okay? That issue. but getting back to the LDS market, the interesting thing is that, you know, I feel that, to show an example of the continuing problems with the way the modernization of the book distribution and the big box stores and the way in which stores have had to adapt in order to survive, has created a couple of ironies for me. For example, BYU Bookstore is one of my biggest distributors of our books, of signature book titles. There's not a single book that they don't carry. That is a wonderful bookstore. That is a great bookstore. In my mind, the U of U Bookstore should be my best bookstore, but they are a big box outlet store owned by the outlet, and and because of that, and up until a year ago, there was no signature book titles at the U of U bookstore, period. So here's the store, the BYU is the store I would think would be the most be concerned about our product, and yet the U of U, which is the store which I thought would be the biggest outlet for us, carries nothing. So that's the irony that's created because of the modern environment of the bookstores.
We've talked about the technology. We've talked about the business models for this. Let's talk about content. Because with all the promise of on-demand publishing, and it's clearly a tremendously promising field, there's no real substantive difference between that and me hitting the print button on my computer over some article I found on the internet in terms of having some sense of editorial oversight. And I don't know if that's a bad thing necessarily. I mean, growing up, in our family, if you wanted to find out the answer to something, you went to those treasured old Encyclopedia Britannicas on the bookshelf, and we would look things up there, and we bought them for our kids when they were growing up, and they just sit there dusty. The kids have no interest in them. Now, if they want to find something out, they go to Wikipedia, which has
no
editorial oversight whatsoever.
It's like a talk show.
And yet, when I've looked up things on Wikipedia where I actually know something about it, which is rare because I don't know very much about anything, I've never actually found them to be inaccurate personally. So maybe our concern there is overstated. But let's talk about that. Let's talk about editorial content and editorial oversight.
Yeah, Amazon just last week announced that they're making it much easier for anyone to self-publish and have their book go on to Amazon even more directly than ever and receive equal treatment as any book published by anybody. So yeah, anybody can put anything up almost now. It's getting easier and easier, and it's going to keep getting easier, I think. So, and that is a problem. For me, I've gotten some editorial help. I have two readers who help me review submissions that come in, to gentlemen who I respect there. So you do need help to even acquire the right books and figure out what needs to be published in the Mormon culture that isn't already being published. And then it does take a fair amount of editorial work to make sure that the books are properly developed editorially by working with the author. And that's, you know, traditionally what you could only get with going with a real publisher, you know, an established publisher. I find that a good way to do it is to work with freelance type editors, some of whom are even willing to volunteer. In fact, I've even worked out arrangements where I've had somebody, I'll give them a percentage of sales for their work up front if I need help. That's how I've handled some of the graphic designers who do my covers. I pay them a small amount, and then I say, if you design a cover that gets some results, then we have some sales. And I do that with proofreading and editing as well. So that's one way to get help. You do need help to do a good job editorially.
Let me just preface everything by saying that I think that the book trade is the worst business model of anything I can think of. The margins are horrible. And yet, in my mind, the book trade is the most important thing we could do as a culture. Anyway, and I have to confess, I am a book snob. Okay, so everything you hear me say, take it through that lens. Okay, I'm a collector. My father had a 70s corn bookstore in the house growing up to help raise money for the missionaries, and I've always had books around. I've gained that love from him. And here's this mechanism where my ancestors and the fathers of my community have been able to communicate to me, and here's this method. And I remember seeing I'm not sure what the name of the press is, but they printed these little plain white LDS book, reprints of LDS books. They're perfect bound, and they're really cheap and crappy, and probably would survive a read or two, and then they would fall apart. And I've always wondered, I was horrified when I first saw them, because I thought, is this really where books are going? You know, is this what I'm going to have on my... when I walk into my library and I look around these books, these are all these great experiences that I've had, every single one of them. You know, the second you close a book, you know, that feeling you feel when you finish a book, you know, I have hundreds of those in my library, and I keep them because they remind me of that. And I walk into my library and I look around and I go, these are my friends, you know. And I think, you know, are my friends, are my grandkids' friends going to be these little crappy white books, you know, that are going to fall apart at any moment, you know. Okay, so admit I'm a book snob. Okay. The concern I have with regards to this print on demand is just as Chris was saying, that when we get a manuscript, it's often a first or a second book by somebody, and we've been doing, our editors have been doing this for 25 years. We have a sense of what quality the book needs to be at, where the writing needs to be at, where the grammar and the punctuation and all that, what level it needs to be at. There are manuals of style that are out there, and it's important so that you don't embarrass yourself that you conform to these types of styles and so forth. And the editor is your is the in-between person between you and the buyer, the reader, and he's the one that's going to keep you from embarrassing yourself and help you fix. Nobody can write a book and not misspell something or miss punctuation or give an analogy that doesn't work, you know, or something. And that's where the editor steps in and saves you. And in this print on demand process, that's not happening. And there's not a second brain or a third and fourth brain there working with you as the author to make sure that the product that is produced in the end is something that is beautiful, is important, is lasting, and is timeless. And it's not uncommon for signature books to, in the end, spend $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 on a book. And so when people say, you know, why are you being so picky about the books that you take? Why can't you take more manuscripts? Because we're spending $40,000 to $60,000 to produce a book that's timeless and important and valuable. And that isn't happening with print on demand, where you can sit on your computer, type it out, email it to Lightning Source, and voila, it's out there. I know my own brothers have put stuff out, and the reviews I get, you know, I hear him saying things all my childhood, but when I think about the larger implication of what he said, oh yeah, he needed an editor. You know, and he doesn't have one. And yet, my oldest brother sold 50,000 copies of a book with that little thing in it, you know. So yeah, he made a lot of money, but is it timeless? No, it's not going to, it's ephemeral.
That's another thing that the big box stores have done, is push the same writers over and over and over again, so that a young, good writer has a really difficult time of getting published. And along with that, the editors are not doing their jobs. They're taking stuff from these big name sellers and publishing total crap. And no, I read a lot of books and I think, where was the editor? A lot of time I spend saying, where was the editor on this book? Couldn't they tell this guy, yes, a good author in general, that this particular paragraph needs to go somewhere else?
Yeah, that's fun because You know, we sometimes, our authors at Signature Books, we're doing Mormon studies quite often, and some of our authors are will be going through an angry period or of their lives and so on and so forth. And, you know, we fight tooth and nail with our authors to calm down the rhetoric and the narrative. And when the book comes out, the critics say, "Look how horrible the rhetoric is in this book," and we're like, "But we calmed it down. We tried so hard," you know. And it would have been far worse had it just gone out as it was. You know, we've really saved a lot of our authors a lot of embarrassment. And the interesting thing is, you know, years later they make peace with whatever, and they're so grateful that we calmed it down, because they would be forever. You know, that these books will be around for hundreds of years. You know, and we've saved them that little bit of embarrassment.
So, Tom, you spoke about the investment that you make in each title that you're publishing. I can't remember the exact figure. You said $50,000. Does that type of investment differ across genres, like a fiction book versus a work of church history or Mormon studies?
Yeah. You know, the elements that you're that I'm speaking for as far as the money, there is the money to print the books. I mean, we usually print 1,000 books initially. So there's that cost, but that's really that's not the real cost. The hidden costs are, I spend 6 months out of my year writing catalogs, and so you have to bring in, you know, we do 10 books a year, so each book gets, you know, 10% of the cost of each of the book, or 5% of the cost of the book goes towards just me writing, the price of having me write catalogs. The production, our production person spends 3, 4, 5 weeks with every book. So her salary has to be thrown into the cost of the book. The editor spends 3, 4, 5 weeks with that book. The cost of that goes into that particular book, and so on and so on and so forth. Keeping the lights on, the rent on the building, the water. You know, if you take all those things and put them into each book, I'm being pretty conservative, $30,000 to $60,000 per book.
Okay.
Right.
One thing I think about as a publisher is, I think there's a big center portion of the Mormon readership that hasn't been identified yet. In other words, what I mean is people between the extremes of Deseret Book, with that sanitized type material that we've been talking about, and then guys like Signature and me, and, well, if you're in the middle, then... there's not very many people in the middle with us, are there? I think I'm in the middle with you, too. I think we're not in the middle that I hope is there. I mean, I'm thinking of people... It seems like there ought to be more Mormon readers who are willing to read a little more adventurous-type stuff.
You underestimate that the best way to hide anything from Mormons is to publish it.
At the same time, I'm from Indiana, and I talk to my parents. I talk to, when I go home, talk to old friends from my ward back there. There are, the number one thing they all ask me is, what are the cool new books out? What should I read? What should I order? What should I get? Because I really think that throughout the church, and the church certainly isn't a Utah church by any means any longer, there's a hunger for good reading material. There are a lot of people in the LDS community who are readers, but who are simply unaware of what's being published. I tell you with my hand on my heart that half my ward back in Indiana has never heard of Signature Books. They don't know that there exists a publisher who does the kind of material that Signature does. If they want to buy a book, they go on to desertbook.com, and they think that's what there is. How can we, and yet we live in an era where the single greatest information disseminator ever invented by man is a regular part of our lives. How can we find a way to connect A and B and C throughout the entire LDS community.
Sorry. One of the great advantages I've had in my life is the fact that I started out as Christmas Help at Desert Book. I had this fantasy, and my fantasy was that I'd go to work at Desert Book, and me and the staff would sit around on the quiet moments and talk theology and history, and it would just be so much fun, and I would learn so much. You know, this would be a great schooling because these are the guys that are not only selling them, they're reading them, they're passionate for them. And so I walked into Desert Book. They hired me on the spot, and they put me in the LDS section, and there was only one other kid out of the 60 employees, maybe even 80 employees, that read Mormon books. And but the other beautiful thing was is that these people would come into the store, and I would start talking to them about, they would ask me about some LDS topic, and I'm like, oh, you know what, there's a couple of books on that. And I'd have them sit down, and I'd bring a book over, and I'd say, you look at that one, I'll be right back. And I'd put two or three books on the table, and the guy would go, sold. And he'd take all of them. You know, I remember one day at this guy came in and we're talking, have a great conversation, and I brought 40 or 50 books over to the table, and we stacked them up, and he's like, yeah, grab that, put that up there, and we had this giant stack on the sale or up on the counter to purchase. And the manager came out, and he's, you know, he wants the store to look clean and nice and not cluttered, and he saw this stack of books up on the counter. And he was coming unglued. What are you guys doing over there? And you know, and one of the other employees walked over and said, "No, they're being bought." You know, it's okay. The Latter-day Saints are starving in many ways. In my experience as a book salesman, they're starving to know what's good and what's fun and what's interesting and what's going to move them. And there isn't anybody out. There's very, very few salesmen in the stores that have read the books and then say, "Hey, you like Hugh Nibley? This is my favorite article from Nibley. It's, you know, the early Christian prayer circles, and it's a hoot." Or Enoch the Prophet, this thing about Lamech and the giants and the watchers. This is kind of a groovy theological thing that he was playing with at this time. It's really funny. You open up and you let them read it, and they buy the book. And there's, unfortunately, there's just so few people out there telling them that, or telling them about Maggie Young's book, Heresies of Nature, and how moved I was in the middle of this book. And yet, there's no one out there telling the customer as they walk in, this book will move you, and it will change your life.
You're a salesman.
And thanks for that.
I thought.
I swear, but the best kind of salesman, because the best kind of salesman is just sharing their heart interest, and people pick up on that. You know, that's really.
I want to ask Jana. Do the blogs help with this?
Yeah, but not on Mormon stuff.
What did you ask? I'm sorry.
Do blogs help with this kind of?
Help move books?
Yeah.
Help sell books? Well, like, I think there's a lot of blogs that have little book groups affiliated with them, like FMH. They read a book a month, I think. Like, on my personal blog, when I'm reading a book, I usually talk about it and put a hyperlink. You know, I get a little, I do the Amazon Associates thing, I get a little kickback for that. So I think the blogs talk books, but I think people who are really into blogs are primarily reading
blogs.
The blogs, and they're getting digested stuff. But like I was talking with FMH Lisa yesterday, and she was saying when she does get a chance to read a book, she becomes a kind of book missionary, and she wants everyone to read it. So she starts blogging about it, gets very enthusiastic about it. So I think in that sense it is helping, but that's not necessarily her primary motivation, is to move books. It's just that she wants to share what she's excited about.
I'm Morris Thurston. We're kind of new to this. My wife and I just published our book, which Tom referred to as a genealogy book, and I've got to keep slapping him across the face. It's the name of it is Breathe Life into Your Life Story, and it's a book on writing is what it is. And we've really been trying to figure out how we can market this beyond just what Signature can do, because Tom is limited in the things that he can do. And a couple of things that we've tried, it may not work so well for fiction books, but we have we're putting up websites, my wife and I who wrote this, and we're going to be putting a blog on the website with the idea that if someone, our goal eventually is that if someone types into Google writing a life story or writing a memoir, that ours will be there on the first page somewhere. And we've talked to various people and consulted how to do that. One thing that Google relies on, besides just the way you set up your site, is how often it changes, how many links are people link to it. So we're setting up not only the blog, which will change on a regular basis, but also podcasts. We've recorded 6 podcasts so far, and we intend to put those out about every 2 weeks or so. And if we can get people to go into there, our book really should apply to a larger audience than just the Mormon audience. So what we're hoping is that the national group of people will log on to there. But I'm thinking that even people that are doing Mormon-related books could perhaps use this. Book clubs, our ward has, the Relief Society has a book club, and they have a number of people who meet every week. I'm not sure how many Mormon groups would have that around the country, but if there was a way to tap into that and let them know what your book is, and that you might be willing to spend 15 minutes or a half an hour during the book club meeting on the phone in a conference type call chatting about the book with them. That might be another way of getting the word out. The other thing is study groups. In Southern California, where we live, we have the Miller-Eccles study group that meets in 2 places, one in our home in Orange County and one in Los Angeles County. And we've had people come, a lot of the Signature authors come and speak to that on a monthly basis, and we'll get anywhere from 30 to, in Richard Bushman's case, 100 people who show up at our home, and they're book buyers. They're the kind of people that really want to learn more about the Mormon topics. And so if these could be set up in more places around the country, I think that would be a fertile area for at least getting the word out as to the existence of the books.
The ultimate extension of print-on-demand is don't print it at all. Would you like to comment on the future of e-books, particularly as the technology improves?
Chris?
Well, you know, I love personally the physical object of books, and I have given in and started to listen to audiobooks, but that's because I'm a captive audience sometimes when I can't have a physical book. But I personally would never choose to read an e-book when I could get the physical book. I think e-books might be good for those books that just don't have enough, that wouldn't do well printed, but I would hate to see them replace the printed book. Well, even but books that are printed, you can easily just give the PDF and have it be online, too.
Well, I'm a college teacher, and my students love things that are online. They see an old-fashioned book as sort of like a horse and buggy at this point. So they want things that they can put on their iPod or whatever device that they have, their laptop. And I commute 2 hours a day each day to my work, so I have an online subscription to Sunstone, online subscription now to Dialogue, and I really enjoy that. I don't really see any difference anymore between reading a physical book and reading a book online or digitally.
I think we're of a different generation, of course, than the... No, but I mean... I'm still of a different generation. And we like books. I mean, I'm a book snob like Tom. I just don't think there's a substitute for it. But the one thing I do like are audiobooks. And I do a large portion of my reading either in the car, working out, taking walks. I love the sound of the book. But if I listen to an audiobook, I always buy the physical book because I want that thing in my library. I want to be able to go back and reference it and all. But I'd love to see, I wish there was a way that Signature could produce their books on audio, because I'd buy every one of the audio tapes. I know that's expensive.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of think, you know, a variety of formats with that, whenever that's feasible, is a way to go. I mean, I think, and I'm also, I mean, I want the book myself too. But I also think, I mean, I work in music business for part of what I do as well, and I just think of, you know, this whole issue came up, that's coming up with books, came up earlier, because now you can have recording equipment in your home, and you've been able to for a while. I mean, better recording equipment than the Beatles recorded Sgt. Pepper on, or Dark Side of the Moon, some of these classics. You can do that in your bedroom. And many people do. It doesn't mean you want to listen to it. I work for a musician who gets given, you know, a lot of demo CDs that people make. And God bless his soul, he listens to at least 10 seconds of each one of them before he throws them away. Most of them just throw them away. He actually listens to it, and every once in a while something will catch his attention. That's how I see print on demand and these other things. I mean, there will be, you know, kind of as a demo, your own demo. Some things there will be, you know, maybe 1-5% of what comes out will be worthwhile, and it may get a regular publisher. For me, I want that regular book. Other people are happy to do print on demand. So I think, you know, a variety of formats is where things are going. And for me, I still will buy a CD rather than an MP3 if the artwork is there, if there are liner notes, if there's a package that is a work of art, I'll buy the work of art.
I'm just going to say, well, we're talking about dinosaur technologies. I'm a theater guy. I love live theater, but it's as big a dinosaur as book publishing. And I get a little bit depressed. I just got back from the Utah Festival Opera and saw their productions up there. And aside from my daughter, I was the youngest person in that theater by a good 25 years, and I'm 51. You know, that's very scary. And yet, I think that there's an aesthetic experience in going to see a live theater event that you can't get anywhere else. By the same token, I think there's an aesthetic experience of sitting down with a beautifully bound and superbly edited book that can't really be found anywhere else. And that's what we have to sell. We have to say there is something still of value with this.
I like Chris's viewpoint on this, because it affects him as well, but... The audio issue is for us is, gee, this is another place we can throw money away. But a bigger issue for me is that within Mormon studies, I'm only reaching an English audience in a global church. And the bigger tragedy for me is the fact that we don't have the skills or the ability to get our books in Spanish. Which would be obviously the first track, and I think that you know our goal is to enlighten, to critical studies, to push the envelope, and to make our culture look more critically at ourselves, with the hope of improving our culture. And if you think of all the Latter-day Saints who are in South America who are not having this opportunity to have critical thought and critical discussion, I mean, I'm only talking Spanish, you know, and having it in an affordable way, I think that's the bigger tragedy. And if we're forced to go somewhere beyond our traditional English production, I think that would be the first step as opposed to an audio.
To tell you the truth, I haven't thought a whole lot about that yet, and I really should be. I wonder if my mind's already starting to think, you know, could you find someone to translate
You know, do you, have you ever tried any of that yet at Signature?
I don't even speak English well.
I was just going to say that that's what something AML is looking to do. We want to publish an edition of Euryanthem now of works entirely from outside the English speaking church, and we think we've got the resources to find translators for at least short fiction and personal essays. So we're working now to have a call for those things, and that's just a tiny first step. And then all the works that we would collect, we would then have available at least online in the native language in which they're written. That's just a tiny baby step, but it's one that I think we need to start working towards.
You know, one thing about this lightning source and the digital printing is that the books I upload to that show up in Japan and Europe. I don't know about South America. Is there? So the distribution channel may already be there. If we can get them translated, and I translated language wise.
I guess I consider myself a book snob too, but not so much from the ownership standpoint. It's more of a content standpoint. I probably read about 25 books a year, and the books that I want to read are probably 100 per year. So there's each year it gets worse and worse. The list that I want to read and the list I'm able to read goes like this. So I'm very picky, and you know, my reading is divided between Mormon nonfiction and fiction, and secular fiction and nonfiction. And I haven't really seen on the Mormon fiction side anything that's worthy to crack that top 25. I want to support the genre. I'm a reader. I love fiction, but you know, we talk about Milton's and Shakespeare's. And maybe I'm just not seeing it. Maybe I should get on the AML list more often and see what you guys are talking about and what the good things are. But I wonder if anybody can comment on that. What are there works out there that are worthy to compete with the greater marketplace that I should be reading?
Let me just suggest two books. One of them was very poorly produced. Help me with the name. Michael Mitchell, Angel on the Danube.
Yeah.
Michael Mitchell.
Alan Mitchell.
I'm sorry. Lovely book. Angel on the Danube.
Great book.
My copy had a blank hole in the middle of every page on the right hand side, and so I had to guess what the word were in the middle. But I'm sad that Signature or I personally wasn't associated with the production of that book. It was good. It's generally available at the moment, or has been recently. Since you produced a novel very recently, by David Cranes, called "Making the Ghost Dance," I personally think it's a must read. Have you read it yet?
Not yet.
Okay. It's stunning.
It's true.
It's absolutely stunning.
You know, I have to be honest with you. I mean, I'm doing a little bit of publishing myself, and I like a couple of the novels that we've put out.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
Well, I don't know that I read a lot of Mormon fiction myself. I love the mainstream national literary stuff. I love, John Updike, and I only have room for about 20 books a year, too. And that's one thing about being a small publisher is that, man, I don't get as much reading or writing of my own done. But other people have.
Well, I can tell you right now on AML list, we're still arguing about Harry Potter, so I wouldn't go there. but what AML does have is an archive of reviews, which I think is a terrific resource. We've got a lot of really first-rate reviews of LDS fiction and LDS nonfiction, for that matter, that are available on our very clunky.
I think there's a lot of blogs that have little book groups affiliated with them, like FMH. They read a book a month, I think.
Like on my personal blog, when I'm reading a book, I usually talk about it and put a hyperlink. You know, I get a little, I do the Amazon associate thing, I get a little kickback for that. So I think the blogs talk books, but I think people who are really into blogs are primarily reading
blogs.
The blogs, and they're, so they're getting digested stuff. But like I was talking with FMH Lisa yesterday, and she was saying when she does get a chance to read a book, she becomes a kind of book missionary, and she wants everyone to read it. So she starts blogging about it, gets very enthusiastic about it. So I think in that sense it is helping, but that's not necessarily her primary motivation, is to move books. It's just that she wants to share what she's excited about.
I'm Morris Thurston, and we're kind of new to this. My wife and I just published our book, which Tom referred to as a genealogy book, and I've got to keep slapping him across the face. It's the name of it is Breathe Life Into Your Life Story, and it's a book on writing is what it is. And we've really been trying to figure out how we can market this beyond just what Signature can do, because Tom is limited in the things that he can do. And a couple of things that we've tried, it may not work so well for fiction books, but we have we're putting up websites, my wife and I who wrote this, and we're going to be putting a blog on the website with the idea that if someone, our goal eventually is that if someone types into Google writing a life story or writing a memoir, that ours will be there on the first page somewhere. And we've talked to various people and consulted how to do that. One thing that Google relies on, besides just the way you set up your site, is how often it changes, how many links are people link to it. So we're setting up not only the blog, which will change on a regular basis, but also podcasts. We've recorded 6 podcasts so far, and we intend to put those out about every 2 weeks or so. And if we can get people to go into there, our book really should apply to a larger audience than just the Mormon audience. So what we're hoping is that the national group of people will log on to there. But I'm thinking that even people that are doing Mormon-related books could perhaps use this. Book clubs, our ward has, the Relief Society has a book club, and they have a number of people who meet every week. I'm not sure how many Mormon groups would have that around the country, but if there was a way to tap into that and let them know what your book is, and that you might be willing to spend 15 minutes or a half an hour during the book club meeting on the phone in a conference type call chatting about the book with them. That might be another way of getting the word out. The other thing is study groups. In Southern California where we live, we have the Miller Eccles study group that meets in 2 places, one in our home in Orange County and one in Los Angeles County. And we've had people come, a lot of the Signature authors come and speak to that on a monthly basis, and we'll get anywhere from 30 to, in Richard Bushman's case, 100 people who show up at our home, and they're book buyers. They're the kind of people that really want to learn more about the Mormon topics. And so if these could be set up in more places around the country, I think that would be a fertile area for at least getting the word out as to the existence of the books.
The ultimate extension of print-on-demand is don't print it at all. Would you like to comment on the future of e-books, particularly as the technology improves? Chris?
Well, you know, I love personally the physical object of books, and I have given in and started to listen to audiobooks, but that's because I'm a captive audience sometimes when I can't have a physical book. But I personally would never choose to read an e-book when I could get the physical book. I think e-books might be good for those books that just don't have enough, that wouldn't do well printed, but I would hate to see them replace the printed book.
But what about your children? What about the next generation?
Well, even the books that are printed, you can easily just give the PDF and have it be online too.
Well, I'm a college teacher, and my students love things that are online. They see an old-fashioned book as sort of like a horse and buggy at this point. So they want things that they can put on their iPod or whatever device that they have, their laptop. And I commute 2 hours a day each day to my work, so I have an online subscription to Sunstone, online subscription now to Dialogue, and I really enjoy that. I don't really see any difference anymore between reading a physical book and reading a book online or digitally.
I think we're of a different generation, of course, I'm still of a different generation. and we like books. I mean, I'm a book snob like Tom. I just don't think there's a substitute for it. But the one thing I do like are audiobooks, and I do a large portion of my reading either in the car, working out, taking walks. I love the sound of the book, but if I listen to an audiobook, I always buy the physical book because I want that thing in my library. I want to be able to go back and reference it and all. But I'd love to see, I wish there was a way that Signature could produce their books on audio, because I'd buy every one of the audio tapes. I know that's expensive.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of think, you know, a variety of formats with that, whenever that's feasible, is a way to go. I mean, I think, and I'm also, I mean, I want the book myself too. But I also think, I mean, I work in music business for part of what I do as well, and I just think of, you know, this whole issue came up, that's coming up with books, came up earlier, because now you can have recording equipment in your home, and you've been able to for a while. I mean, better recording equipment than the Beatles recorded Sgt. Pepper on, or Dark Side of the Moon, some of these classics, you can do that in your bedroom. And many people do. It doesn't mean you want to listen to it. I work for a musician who gets given, you know, a lot of demo CDs that people make, and God bless his soul, he listens to at least 10 seconds of each one of them before he throws them away. most of them just throw them away. He actually will listen to it, and every once in a while something will catch his attention. That's how I see print on demand and these other things. I mean, there will be, you know, kind of as a demo, your own demo. Some things, there will be, you know, maybe 1-5% of what comes out will be worthwhile, and it may get a regular publisher. For me, I want that regular book. Other people are happy to do print on demand. So I think, you know, a variety of formats is where things are going. And for me, I still will buy a CD rather than an MP3 if the artwork is there, if there are liner notes, if there's a package that is a work of art. I'll buy the work of art.
I was just going to say, well, we're talking about dinosaur technologies. I'm a theater guy. I love live theater, but it's as big a dinosaur as book publishing. And I get a little bit depressed. I just got back from Utah Festival Opera and saw their productions up there. And aside from my daughter, I was the youngest person in that theater by a good 25 years, and I'm 51. You know, that's very scary. And yet, I think that there's an aesthetic experience in going to see a live theater event that you can't get anywhere else. By the same token, I think there's an aesthetic experience of sitting down with a beautifully bound and superbly edited book that can't really be found anywhere else. And that's what we have to sell. We have to say there is something still of value with this.
I like Chris's viewpoint on this, because it affects him as well. But the audio issue is for us is, gee, this is another place we can throw money away. But a bigger issue for me is that within Mormon studies, I'm only reaching an English audience in a global church. And the bigger tragedy for me is the fact that we don't have the skills or the ability to get our books in Spanish.
which would be obviously the first track. And I think that you know our goal is to enlighten, to do critical studies, to push the envelope, and to make our culture look more critically at ourselves, with the hope of improving our culture. And if you think of all the Latter-day Saints who are in South America who are not having this opportunity to have critical thought and critical discussion, I mean, I'm only talking Spanish, you know, and having it in an affordable way, I think that's the bigger tragedy. And if we're forced to go somewhere beyond our traditional English production, I think that would be the first step as opposed to an audio.
To tell you the truth, I haven't thought a whole lot about that yet, and I really should be. I wonder if my mind's already starting to think, you know, could you find someone to translate? You know, have you ever tried any of that yet at Signature?
I don't even speak English well.
I was just going to say that that's what something AML is looking to do. We want to publish an edition of Variantum now of works entirely from outside the English speaking church, and we think we've got the resources to find translators for at least short fiction and personal essays. So we're working now to have a call for those things, and that's just a tiny first step. And then all the works that we would collect, we would then have available at least online in the native language in which they're written. That's just a tiny baby step, but it's one that I think we need to start making towards.
You know, one thing about this lightning source and the digital printing is that the books I upload to that show up in Japan and Europe. I don't know about South America. Is there? So the distribution channel may already be there. If we can get them translated, and I translated language wise.
I guess I consider myself a book snob too, but not so much from the ownership standpoint. It's more of a content standpoint. I probably read about 25 books a year, and the books that I want to read are probably 100 per year. So there's each year it gets worse and worse. The list that I want to read and the list I'm able to read goes like this. So I'm very picky, and you know, my reading is divided between Mormon nonfiction and fiction, and secular fiction and nonfiction. And I haven't really seen on the Mormon fiction side anything that's worthy to crack that top 25. I want to support the genre. I'm a reader. I love fiction, but you know, we talk about Milton's and Shakespeare's. And maybe I'm just not seeing it. Maybe I should get on the AML list more often and see what you guys are talking about and what the good things are. But I wonder if anybody can comment on that. What are there works out there that are worthy to compete with the greater marketplace that I should be reading?
Let me just suggest two books. One of them was very poorly produced. Help me with the name. Michael Mitchell, Angel in the Danube.
Oh, yeah.
Michael Mitchell.
Alan Mitchell, I'm sorry.
Lovely book. Angel on the Danube.
Great book.
Great book. My copy had a blank hole in the middle of every page on the right-hand side. And so I had to guess what the word were in the middle. But I'm sad that Signature, or I personally, wasn't associated with the production of that book. It was good.
Is it generally available?
It's generally available at the moment, or has been recently. Signature produced a novel very recently, by David Cranes, called Making the Ghost Dance. I personally think it's a must read. Have you read it yet?
Not yet.
Okay. It's stunning. It's absolutely stunning.
You know, I have to be honest with you. I mean, I'm doing a little bit of publishing myself,
and I like a couple of the novels that we've put out.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
Well, I don't know that I read a lot of Mormon fiction myself. I love the mainstream national literary stuff. I love, John Updike, and I only have room for about 20 books a year, too. And that's one thing about being a small publisher is that, man, I don't get as much reading or writing of my own done. But other people have...
Well, I can tell you right now on AML List, we're still arguing about Harry Potter, so I wouldn't go there. But what AML does have is an archive of reviews, which I think is a terrific resource. We've got a lot of really first-rate reviews of LDS fiction and LDS nonfiction, for that matter, that are available on our very clunky and soon-to-be-updated website. And that's certainly a resource. Unfortunately, we're as obscure as anybody else, but I think that if there were more clearinghouses for information, and especially reviews of good works, I think it would help everybody. I would also add Margaret Young's Heresies of Nature, which is a tremendous book, and then the other fact is that we have, really first-rate LDS novelists who are publishing in national markets now, and that's always a good development. And we're out of time. Thank you all for a great discussion. This was very fun. It was nice to talk to more book people. Okay, thanks a lot. Thanks to Chris and to Tom.